Go ahead, Michelle.
Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for joining our Google Hangout today. I'm Michelle Mittelstadt with the Migration Policy Institute, and we're delighted that you're able to join us for this conversation on U.S. immigration policy. Earlier today, we released a brief that looks at major provisions of the immigration reform bill passed by the Senate in June against those of bills that are pending in the House. You can find that brief, as well as an earlier series of briefs that we've done on different facets of the immigration reform debate, at our website, migrationpolicy.org/CIR. During this chat, we invite you to ask questions, which you can send to us by emailing us at communications@migrationpolicy.org or by tweeting them using the hashtag MPICIR. Hangout, and we're going to start with a sort of an informal conversation, and we will then later get to as many of your questions as we can. So with that, I would like to introduce our two speakers today, Doris Meisner and Muzaffar Chishti. Doris directs our U.S. Immigration Policy Program, and Muzaffar directs MPI's office in New York, which is based at NYU School of Law. So we're just, as I mentioned, going to have start an informal conversation and after that get to your questions. So with that, Doris, I would like to ask you a first question, which is, you know, as we know, the Senate did approve a comprehensive immigration reform bill in June, and there have been a variety of bills pending in the House that have been approved in some committees. The House strategy is a little different than the Senate one, so could you talk a little bit about the difference in approaches between the two chambers?
Absolutely, and good afternoon, everybody. Let me add my thanks to you for joining us for this video chat. Well, as Michelle said, of course, the Senate passed a bill in June, and there was some hope or some thought, I think, at that time for a while that perhaps the House would take up the bill that the Senate passed. But that very quickly became clear that that was not going to happen. The House has made clear that it is intending to do its own process, that its own process will be a different process. And what's emerged is that that process will be what's being referred to now as a piecemeal process. There was, for a while, an effort in the House that would have yielded a comprehensive bill somewhat similar to what happened in the Senate with a bipartisan group, but my understanding is that that has been abandoned. So what we have now in a piecemeal approach is individual bills that speak to particular issues of immigration reform, but in discrete pieces of legislation. And there are presently five of those bills. Four of them have been enacted by the House Judiciary Committee under the chairmanship of Robert Goodlatte of Virginia, and the other has been enacted by the Homeland Security Committee under the leadership of Michael McCaul from Texas. Those bills are the subject of this side-by-side. I mean, since that is what it is that is ready for House action because it's through the committee process, those are the bills that we've looked at in this side-by-side and arrayed them next to what it is that the Senate passed. The five of them are as follows. First one is called, or in no particular order, the Border Security Results Act, which has to do, of course, with border security, an Agricultural Guest Worker Act, which is ag workers, Legal Workforce Act, and that's the act that has to do with employer and employment verification. Then there's an act called the SAFE Act, which has to do with interior enforcement, and finally there's an act called the Skills Act, which has to do with high-skilled immigration. So those are the bills that are now in play. They would be ready for action by the full House whenever it is that the Speaker might schedule them for a vote. But those are what we're dealing with substantively on the House side at the present time.
Great. Thank you, Doris. Muzaffar, could you outline some of the major elements that can be found in the Senate immigration legislation that are not found in any of the House bills that have been considered to date?
Thank you, Michelle, and good afternoon or good morning to all of you, depending on what time zone you are in. Clearly, there's a big difference in approach between what the Senate passed at the end of June and the House bills that have moved through markup so far. And the big difference is the Senate is obviously a very comprehensive approach. And as Doris laid out, the House bills are piecemeal approaches to different aspects of immigration policy. And, you know, I think the obvious thing to say is the Senate bill is not only comprehensive in its name, it is hugely a big look at our entire waterfront of immigration policy making. It sort of covers the entire nook and corner of our immigration policy, from border to interior enforcement to workplace to detention and removal of people to the discretion of immigration judges, all the way to issues of integration. There's hardly a piece in our immigration system that the Senate bill does not touch. On the other side, the House bills are narrow in their focus, and they're very targeted for specific sort of goals in their mind. And let me just lay out sort of the broadly speaking what the fundamental differences are. It's quite clear that there is no element in any House bill regarding the unauthorized population in the U.S. There is not any legalization program in any of the House bills. And in the Senate bill, obviously, the legalization program is the core, is a core, if not one of the cores of the of the bill. So the absence of the legalization provision is obviously a major difference between the two chambers at this point. Even on legal immigration, where there is a House bill, the Skills Act, even there on that issue, there is a sharp difference between how the Senate approaches it and how the House bill approaches it. The Senate bill is a re-look at our immigration legal system writ large, from the way we treat non-immigrants of different varieties to the way we treat people for citizenship. The House bill, on the other hand, is highly focused on high-skilled immigrants. It does deal something with diversity issues and the provision regarding the siblings of U.S. citizens, which we can get into later. But it is a heavily focused bill on high-skilled immigrants. It increases the number of visas for certain high-skilled categories of immigrants that we want into our system. Then there's obviously a huge difference in between the Senate and the House on approaches towards detention policy. The Senate bill actually prefers that we detain as few people as we need to, given their criminal background or their national security risk. The House bill, on the other hand, encourages people to be detained. It increases the funding and the personnel for detention. It actually discourages DHS from using its exercising its discretion in not detaining people. It similarly bans the DHS from exercising any discretion in prosecuting people. So the prosecutorial discretion that has become one of the defining elements of the administration's policy in the last 2 years will be banned and reversed under the House bill. And finally, on issues of integration, there is no mention of integration of immigrants in any of the House bills. The Senate bill, on the other hand, creates an Office of Citizenship and New Americans. It creates an interagency task force to deal with issues of integration, and it provides grants to states and localities for their various integration efforts. So I would say those are, broadly speaking, the elements of differences between the two approaches.
And when you look particularly at what can be found in House bills that have been considered to date that don't have a parallel in the Senate legislation, what would be some of the key things that would come to mind?
Well, the key things that immediately emerge if you look at these bills is that the House approach is heavily focused on interior enforcement. There are broad similarities between the bills on some border provisions, but in interior enforcement, there is huge significant divergence. A, there is obviously increase not only in funding, but increase in the new penalties for various crimes and establishing new crimes under our federal immigration system. For example, it for the first time makes legal presence in the U.S. a federal misdemeanor, which hasn't been the case so far. It expands the list of aggravated felonies. It expands the grounds of inadmissibility to include everything like the use of fraudulent use of a Social Security card. And it actually requires the DHS to to fund new detention spaces, and it reimburses the states for the cost of detaining people in their own jurisdiction. And I think it bars the DHS from implementing some of the prosecutorial discretion policy guidelines that I listed early on. But most significantly, it is a huge boost to the enforcement efforts of the states and localities. It actually states that state and local law enforcement agencies should have the ability to investigate, detain, apprehend, and then transfer people who are unauthorized in this country. How that stacks up with the Supreme Court's decision last year in U.S. versus Arizona, we'll have to see. Secondly, it encourages the states to detain people whom they consider to have violated federal immigration law, and forces the DHS to issue detainers on those people and then take custody of those people within 48 hours if they're referred to by the state authorities. And it actually requires the DHS to approve any application for a cooperative agreement like the 287G, which the federal government has been paying less and less reliance on. It says that unless there is a good cause not to approve an application for a 287G, it must be approved within 90 days. So in terms of the increasing role of the states and localities and federal immigration law, the House bill, specifically through the SAFE Act, is a big nod in favor of more increased involvement of federal and local enforcement agencies.
Great. Thank you, Muzaffar. Doris, I mean, Muzaffar has just really signaled some of the major differences between the two chambers over interior enforcement. Turning to border enforcement, could you likewise talk a little bit about some of the differences and approaches between the two chambers?
Well, border enforcement is clearly a big issue for both chambers, but there are significant differences between the Senate approach and the House approach on border enforcement. We'll probably all recall the debate at the end of the Senate consideration, how it really turned on the border enforcement measures. It's probably the one area in the Senate bill that had the most significant changes through the amendment process from what it is that the Gang of Eight first laid out and what was then marked up in the Judiciary Committee for full Senate floor consideration. So the way the Senate bill ended up was with this amendment, very sweeping amendment called the Corker-Haven Amendment, and that is the amendment that has become very well known for the amounts of money that it invests in future increased resources for border enforcement. Depending on how you count it, it's anywhere between $30 to probably $42.5 billion over the next 10 years. And that would result in a doubling of the Border Patrol, considerable additional investments in technology, 700 miles of fencing. So that what it is that the Senate banked on and ultimately enacted, and of course this was a political agreement that was absolutely essential to getting to yes in the Senate enacting the bill, but it was pulled together hurriedly, and it was very much a political negotiation more than a substantive analysis. What it ultimately rests on is the idea that the resource buildup that has been taking place at the border for border enforcement for at least 10, if not 20 to 25 years, should continue. It buys into, or it basically supports, the idea of additional resources at the southwest border, both for ports of entry as well as between the ports of entry. The House is taking a different approach. The House's border security legislation is focused on goals. It's focused on outcomes. It is looking at outputs. It is looking at metrics of effectiveness of the resources that have currently been invested in the border and how it is that those are in fact being used to bring about border enforcement. So the focus in the House is actually on effectiveness and on accountability. And it is leaving to the Department of Homeland Security and to Customs and Border Protection the methods or the means that they think they ought to use in order to get to effectiveness. Now, the two bills are quite similar in looking at numbers like 90% of effectiveness rate, but the process by which the House bill gets there is an entirely different process from what it is that was laid out in the Senate bill. The House has no triggers in any way in its border enforcement that link to legalization. Now, that's not a surprise because there isn't a legalization provision yet on the table in the House. But the House Border Security Bill is a standalone effort. It is focusing on the metrics of effectiveness within a 2-year time frame and then extended to a 5-year time frame. It looks to the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security to certify to the Congress, according to various criteria, the results or the outcomes that DHS is achieving at the border. And then it also looks at the looks to the GAO to provide review and to provide validation of what it is that the executive branch is certifying to the Congress. Of entry and between the ports of entry in terms of what it is that it looks for results and for metrics.
I think we may be experiencing technical difficulties. We've just lost Michelle for just a minute. I'm sure she'll be joining us back in just a second. In the meantime, maybe
well, I think maybe let's just go from there to talking about some of the other details in the differences in the bills. Bruce, how about employer verification?
I think from border, let's move on for a second to verification of the authorized status of the workplace. And this is sort of where the discussion is mostly talked about, the electronic employment verification system. If you really had to take one of the provisions in these two approaches, which have the most commonality, I would say the electronic employment verification system is one of them, because both chambers have been grappling with this issue for a long time, and we have had a lot of experience with this electronic verification system beginning in 1996. So there's much more consensus in between the House and the Senate on how to approach the issue of employment authorization. Let me state the most important commonalities, that the world of work and the world of workplace will change fundamentally for all workers in this country, not just citizens but non-citizens and citizens alike, if this bill becomes law. And that is, for the first time, we will begin to have a mandatory system for electronic verification for every worker who is employed in the country after enactment. The electronic verification system, which sometimes in the past has been called e-verify, is staggered in for its implementation depending on the size of the employer's workforce. It starts with people who work for national security concern, or people who work for federal contractors, to people who work for companies that hire more than 10,000 workers, to then to more than 5,000 to everyone else. But it's going to become mandatory under the Senate bill within 4 years for all employers, and it's going to become mandatory within 24 months under the House bill, and which basically means that anyone who applies for a job, that person's work authorization and their biometric information about their identity will be checked against a federal database, which is a combination of DHS's database and Social Security Administration's database. And the system will provide the employer with notification whether the person about whom the inquiry is being submitted is lawfully authorized to work in this country or no. And if the notification is not, then you obviously have to remove that person from employment. Now, that's the broad outline of how the electronic verification system is going to be implemented. There also is a significant similarity in the fines that employers will be subjected to if they're found violating the employment sanctions law of our immigration system. And the fines actually go up hugely from the current law. Right now, you know, an employer pays a fine of $250 for the first violation. Now, the fines for the first violation under the Senate bill is going to be like $3,500 to about $7,500. Under the House bill, $2,500 to $5,000. For the third violation, is going to go up from $10,000 to $25,000 in per worker in both the bills. So there is a big ramping up of the fines that employers will have to pay if either of these approaches become law. In the Senate bill, and for the pattern of practice, I'm sorry, I should add, if there's a pattern of practice established, then an employer could be subjected both to fines and a jail term of about 24 months or 18 months, depending on whether it's the Senate or the House approach. I think an interesting approach in the Senate bill is that an employer has violated the sanctions law with respect to 10 workers. And on top of that, it's also found that the person has violated the labor laws of our country. That person could be subjected to a jail term of up to 10 years. So obviously the Senate is taking a more comprehensive look at the combination of just not just violating the employer sanctions law, but also violating the labor protection laws, and if the two are put combined, then the employer is at heavier risk. There is some significant difference, I think, between the House and the Senate approach in sort of the good faith defense that an employer can use in invoking protections from sanctions. That in the House bill, there seems to be more latitude given to the employers for relying on the good faith compliance. And in the House bill, that if you really have complied in good faith, then even the amount of fine could be reduced. There, I think, is some basic difference between the two approaches in what would happen if someone believes that they were wrongfully laid off or terminated as a result of the non-confirmation of their authorized stay by the verification system. Under the Senate bill, it's actually significantly protective towards such workers who may be deemed not to be authorized because of the negligence or failure of the system. They can take their complaint to an administrative law judge, and the administrative law judge can give that person back order, sort of orders for the back pay of the wages lost. And people can take their appeals as far up as the courts of appeal in our federal judicial system. And the House bill, the only way you can actually redress a claim of having been sort of wrongly terminated as a result of the negligence of the electronic verification system is under the Federal Tort Claims Act, and that's obviously much less of a robust mechanism for people to be able to get their claims. So I think those are some of the obvious differences. One difference which I think has gotten very little attention is under the House bill, there actually is a possibility that parts or the entire electronic verification system can be delegated by DHS to a non-governmental entity, which could actually include a private contractor. So you could see the possibility of private contractors or private agencies being involved in the running of the electronic verification system.
Okay, we want to move on to some of the employment-based provisions, but I need to loop back and say one other thing about border security, which I fail to mention that is significant, I think, in the House border security proposal, and that is that the House border security proposal does put a very heavy emphasis on ports of entry. It also puts a very heavy emphasis in its metrics on not only immigration metrics, but drug enforcement metrics. And that's something that we don't really see in the Senate side, but that we do see in the House side. On the House side, also, there are no mandates whatsoever regarding fencing. There is not an emphasis on fencing, whereas in the Senate, you do have this emphasis on fencing. So I think it's fair to say that where the House and border security are concerned, the bill that came out of the House from a process standpoint has had a much deeper history of hearings and of effort to develop a border security approach for the House as compared to the very quick manner in which the Senate put together its provision. And interestingly, where the House border security bill is concerned, it was marked out of that committee and voted out with strong bipartisan support by all of the members. So with that addendum, let's move on to employment-based. Michelle, I think we have you back, right?
Yes, and I'm sorry, Doris, for the technical difficulty. I lost you there for a bit, so I apologize for that. So, could you, getting to employment-based immigration then, and I'm sorry for missing earlier, could you outline, Doris, the differences between the two approaches, the two chambers, with respect specifically to agricultural workers?
Yes, well, agricultural workers are an area, of course, that has now had a separate bill enacted in the House Judiciary Committee, and it is a bill that deals both with agricultural workers in the future as well as agricultural workers who are in the country in an unauthorized status. In terms of the future flow of agricultural workers, it establishes a new visa. It's calling it an H-2C visa, which is an ag worker program. It is different from the current agricultural seasonal worker in that it is a multi-year employment visa. And for some people who have that visa, it would allow for portability of that visa. It also, for those in the country who are in agriculture, who are in an unauthorized status, it does allow them to apply for the current H-2A program and then reapply for this new H-2C program, but it has a touchback provision in it. So that new H-2C access to that new program would require returning and applying for it from abroad. The significant feature, though, about the temporary worker program for the unauthorized who are in the U.S. as compared with what is going on in the Senate is that there is no path to citizenship or to lawful permanent residence in that temporary worker program. I think it's fair to characterize the House approach to the agricultural worker issue as a classic guest worker program. That is to say that it is a broadening of the current H-2A program that is currently in place, but it still is a program that is limited in time. It's a maximum of 18 months in a temporary or a seasonal work status, maximum then, because it's renewable, to 3 years for non-seasonal work. It does require returning to the home country. It is capped at a very high number. It is capped at 500,000, but that 500,000 is adjustable by the Secretary of Agriculture, but adjustable only downwards. 500,000 is the maximum cap. And of course, as a classic guest worker program, it keeps the worker tied to the employer. There are certain features that allow people then to move, but basically it's a program that ties the worker to the employer. The difference between that and what the Senate has done is that the Senate's agricultural worker provisions are considerably more expansive. In the Senate agricultural worker provisions, you have the current agricultural workers who are in an unauthorized status are specifically able to apply for the legalization program that's in the Senate. So they can apply for provisional status. And they do that by getting a new visa, which is known as a blue card visa. They are able to make that application within 5 years. They're then, once they have that blue card, they are able within 5 years to adjust to lawful permanent residence as long as they have remained in agriculture. And they're able to do that not only for themselves as the principal applicant, but for their dependents. So there's nothing that speaks to anything along those lines in the House bill, because, of course, as we've said, the House bill doesn't deal with a legalization element. In the future, the key difference between the Senate bill and the House bill is also a difference of expansiveness, because for agricultural workers in the future in the Senate bill, they are, in certain circumstances, once they're here with a new visa, they can get what's called a W-3 visa or a W-4 visa, depending on what kind of an agricultural worker they are. That's a visa that allows them to remain here initially for 3 years. It's then renewable for 3 years. It's capped at a very different number from the House. It's capped at 112,333. If you asked me how in the world one came up with that number, I don't know, but it is 112,333. That, though, can be adjusted by the Secretary of Agriculture, and that can be adjusted either way. That's a visa that is portable for many of these workers among a list of registered employers. The wage criteria for that visa are written into the statute, which is different from what is going on in the House bill. And I think perhaps the ultimate difference between the Senate and the House approach then, where future agricultural workers is concerned, are concerned, is that those agricultural workers under the Senate bill, some of them could ultimately qualify, or they're at least eligible to apply for a permanent visa, a lawful permanent resident visa, through the merit-based visa system and the point system that's laid out in the Senate bill. There is no counterpart to that in the House bill.
Great. We have a lot of questions coming in, so I'm just going to ask you a couple of last questions, and then we'll go to the questions that we're getting from our viewers. Legalization for unauthorized immigrants is obviously a major area of difference between the two chambers at this point. Doris, could you outline, you know, what's happening in the difference in approaches between the two, between the House and the Senate at this moment on that?
Well, of course, as we've said from the outset, that is one of the major differences, is that the House doesn't have anything on legalization. And it certainly is the most politically difficult question within the House. There is some discussion taking place. There's not a bill. There isn't anything close to what it is that we've been describing in this discussion up until now. But there has been a hearing in the last couple of weeks on something that could result in what's being termed the KIDS Act, kids as in young people. And that does represent some movement, because up until now there has been, you know, there have been a lot of statements from various members of the House in the Republican caucus that they will not have a legalization feature of any kind. So the effort to look at young people is a shift. And but it's interesting, what easily comes to our minds and to our language when we talk about that kind of a provision is Dreamers and Dream Act, and the discussion about Dream Act, which has a very special place in the Senate's consideration of a legalization program. The House is not using the word Dream or Dream Act eligible at all. They're talking about young people and about kids. They are talking, perhaps, there have been some comments from the House about a possible legal status that would be simply a registered status beyond young people, that would not lead to a path to citizenship, would not permit adjustment. But that is even more unformed at this point than the discussion of the KIDS Act. So I think that what we have to say is that although there is some discussion in various parts of the House and importantly in the Judiciary Committee, which has the jurisdiction, the primary jurisdiction over this issue. We don't know how that's going to play out, and that will continue to be probably the one of the two or three single biggest differences between the Senate and the House right now.
Great. Before we go to questions from our viewers, let me just wrap up with a final question for both of you, which is, you know, Congress is on recess. This is going to be a very consequential period, I think, where actors on all sides of the immigration debate are trying to make their voices heard with members in their congressional districts. You know, the question I have is, you know, what do you see happening when Congress returns from this recess? Maybe Doris, start with you first, and then Mr. Farr.
Okay. So, from everything we know, when they come back, which of course will be September, the debate will be dominated by fiscal and budget issues. So, to just be very brief about it, I think it's unlikely and unrealistic to imagine that there will be anything formal going on during September. But statements from the House have said that they expect to return to immigration in October. If then, what does it mean to return to immigration in October? Well, a couple of things could happen. There could be an effort to bring the bills that we've discussed and that are in the side-by-side to a vote on the Senate floor, which would demonstrate, on the House floor, which would of course demonstrate that the House is moving forward with its piecemeal strategy. If that happens, probably or possibly the bill that would go first would be the border security bill, so that the House could make a strong statement on border enforcement, which of course has been a major preoccupation of the debate and certainly a major concern and issue in the House. Or the Speaker could decide to hold these bills and let the House determine whether there are any additional bills that might be added to the list, and then bundle the individual bills and have a series of votes very quickly later in the fall on all of the bills that have been marked up and reported out. That's already taking us quite far ahead, and I think it will depend very much on events between now and then before we're able to really guesstimate anything further than that.
Muzaffar?
I think August is a big deal in terms of what members will be hearing in their home districts. I mean, obviously there's going to be a significant pressure on them from both ends of the political spectrum of this. I mean, advocates of immigration reform are going to, I think, put more and more pressure in the home districts through different and varied constituencies that are important to the members of Congress. And people who are opposed to an immigration reform like the one that Senate is talking about would obviously put pressure on their members. I think the issue here really is the calendar. I think all of us know by now, in September there are only like 9 calendar days left, and with the kind of competing priorities that Congress will face in fiscal cliff and then the budget, obviously when they move into October, those are going to take precedence. So I think the chances of anything like a significant advance on immigration in October does not look very promising. I think the probability of House taking up immigration in a serious way in November are probably higher if the fiscal and budgetary issues are dealt with in October. I think the issue at that point is simply going to be in what manner do these bills get put together and taken to conference. It's quite possible that all these separate bills may move through the House chamber and may get approved, and then a rule will be established to put them in some form together to take it to conference in the House to between the House and the Senate, and whether there is enough of a conferenceable agenda then is going to be determined by the leadership of the conference. I mean, just to a single simple example, if the House combined bills do not have a provision on legalization, then obviously the supporters of the Senate bill and the president will have to decide whether to conference on a set of bills that does not have a legalization provision is feasible or no. But the important thing, I think, to note is that it looks like, from all calculations one can make, is that there are votes in the House to pass some immigration reform, even, I think, akin to a Senate bill. So the issue is not the presence or absence of votes. The issue is whether it will be brought up for a vote or no. And that decision can only be made by the leadership of the House, and this is particularly by the Speaker. And I think the Speaker is facing a very difficult choice here between what he believes, I think, is important and necessary even for the future of the Republican Party, and what he probably believes is even good for the national interest of the country, and on the other hand, how he sees the majority of his own Republican caucus, their position on this issue. And those positions may get hardened or loosened during this recess, and I think that would be very important. But I think there, frankly, is no way of escaping that the ultimate analysis, whether it's a possibility of a new comprehensive approach coming to the House, or the piecemeal legislations of forming a package, the vote ultimately will have to be decided whether the Speaker will bring it up for a vote without the support of the majority of the Republican caucus. And I think from all that we know, important as that decision is, critical is as it is to the future of Islam, I don't think he has quite made up his mind on that issue.
Great. Well, thank you both. We've been getting a lot of questions here, I think, that are sort of crystal ball questions asking you to gaze forward, looking in the future, and I think you have provided some answers on some of those. One of the, I think, the recurring themes on the questions that we're getting right now, though, is actually at the end of the day, if you see something happening this year and including a path to citizenship. So I don't know if you'd want to elaborate any further on that.
I don't know that we can say more than we've said. I think it is clear that the House is trying perhaps to work on some elements of what would be considered part of the legalization set of issues, but how they go forward and what they ultimately decide they will do, I think, remains very fluid.
Yeah, I think the only thing additional I would say is that I think the calendar, as I said, is very important. If we run out of time in 2013, the issue is, would there be enough space left on the calendar to do something in the early part of 2014, which is when the primary elections will heat up. So I think that that calendar is going to be stacked against the primary calendar. And those calculations will have to be made by the leadership again if we don't finish this business by the end of 2013.
Great, thank you. We have questions on a lot of different topics, so I'm going to try and cover as much ground as possible. We have a question that came in over Twitter asking if there's appetite in the House, to your mind, for anything having to do with immigrant integration, such as adult education, provision of ESL services, for example. Doris, maybe take that one?
In the House.
In the House.
The question about the House. We certainly haven't seen anything. There isn't anything in, I'm just trying to think, in any of these bills that we've read, I don't recall any provisions that have to do with what we would consider immigrant integration. Moose, does anything come to your mind?
No, there's nothing in any of these House bills which has even gone in that direction. But the Senate bill, as I said early on the other hand, has a significant attention to issues of integration, both from the government side of creating a new office, of creating interagency task force, and of actually funding states and local governments for the integration efforts. And for the first time, I think, establishing a citizenship fund which would allow people, both private actors and public, to contribute to a fund which would help pay for the legalization costs and its implementation. And, you know, that's a significant new rethinking in the issue of the importance of citizenship for integration.
Okay, great. We have a couple of questions that have come in on E-Verify, so I'm going to ask these together right now. One of which is the E-Verify system proposed in the Senate bill the same system that's currently being used by DHS?
I think it's pretty close to what's being used by the DHS. In the, as you know, these are all the present program is a voluntary program, and the new is going to be increasingly mandatory. I think the difference is that there will be much more attention in the new Senate, and that's true even in the House proposal, of trying to deal with the issues of identity, that the person who actually submits the documentation about their work authorization or the persons about whom the documentation applies. And I think there's much more effort in improving the identification elements of the verification system than in the current system that is in operation.
Great. To follow on that, we have a question from Arizona. Regarding employment verification and asking about the problems that can be anticipated with a mandatory massive rollout of the system.
Well, you know, it's quite clear that when you have a system that has to potentially cover anything from 7.5 to 8 million employers is a big leap. And I think the issue is whether the timeline that has been established for moving towards mandatory is a realistic timeline on the, or no. I think the Senate timeline of 4 years is probably more realistic than the 24-month timeline in the House bill. I think it suggested actually even in the House bill that if the DHS certifies to Congress that the implementation along the timelines is not working, then extensions can be granted with respect to timelines for each step of the process. So I think we don't frankly know whether the technology is developed enough for it to move at the rate at which the bills mandate. But obviously the first phase of the implementation will tell us a lot about the problems with implementation. And I suspect that if one sees a lot of problems with the speed of the implementation in the very first stage, then Congress may have to review whether the timeline makes sense or not.
Great. Thank you, Muzaffar. I'm getting a couple more questions, and I think we'll probably have to wrap it up after that. Doris, I'll ask you this one. There's a viewer who mentions that the Senate bill prohibits DHS from requiring electronic filing of adjustment of status and naturalization applications until the year 2020. And the question is, shouldn't USCIS be moving away from paper and encouraging electronic filing? And wouldn't having digital data speed up processing, cut costs, and help identify fraud?
I think that it would, and I think that there is a tremendous opportunity in a new bill, and particularly in a legalization program, should that be enacted, to start fresh with a much more automated process and with a process that is modern in terms of what it is that can be accomplished. I do think, though, that the Congress and others have been very concerned at the same time that going to an entirely electronic process could reduce access to the process for some in the immigrant community, older people, people that have less access to technology. So my sense of these provisions is that they really are looking for a both and, which is to say that electronic processing and a much more streamlined and updated, modernized way of interacting with the government through programs like the legalization program are being encouraged, but at the same time that there be a fallback in the system so that those people who may not be able to access the process in that way are not cut out of it.
Okay. Great. And I think we'll end with a question here having to do with interior enforcement and with the House SAFE Act. Maybe Muzaffar, you can take this one, which is the question of what do you believe the increased collaboration between the federal government and the state and local governments as, permitted or encouraged under the SAFE Act would ultimately mean?
It's a good question. I mean, I think the country has struggled a lot on this issue of the devolution of immigration enforcement to states and localities, or the cooperation between federal and state governments. And we by now have a very strong, important decision by the U.S. Supreme Court last year, unusually strong for a court which tries to gingerly deal with issues of immigration, that they see immigration law fundamentally as federal province, that immigration law is almost akin to foreign policy, where states and localities have limited role. And I think the tendency in the SAFE Act is to try to reverse that. And the tendency is almost to finish the business that Congress did not do in 1996 law, in sort of increasing enforcement in general and increasing the role of states and localities in particular in that. I think the limits of what that cooperation are going to be probably are going to be tested once again in a court decision by the Supreme Court. My sense is that if the cooperation involves the federal government's policy being implemented in cooperation with state, that the federal government decides these are our priorities and we would like help from states and localities in implementing that. That is probably going to meet the constitutional test, and that probably may be even good for law enforcement. But if the priorities of the states and localities in telling the federal government as to what they should be doing in federal law enforcement, I think is problematic both in terms of this constitutionality and in terms of the impact that will have on local communities, especially immigrant communities, which are very important, I think, for all kinds of reasons and for law enforcement depend on. The more the law enforcement at local and state level gets involved in immigration law, the higher price it has to pay in getting the cooperation from immigrant communities for its important law enforcement and national security interests and priorities, and they get compromised, and that's obviously not very good policy and probably not very good law.
Doris, do you have anything that you'd like to add on this or any other topic that we've discussed today?
I think we've covered a lot. No, thanks.
Okay, great. Well, everybody, thank you so much for joining our chat today. We hope that this was of value. We remind that the side-by-side that we put out today is available on our website, migrationpolicy.org. We will be coming out with additional briefs in the coming days, weeks, and months ahead, and we'll be doing more of these hangouts, so we invite you to stay tuned and to join us again. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.